This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What this shows is the level to which children have been in the shadows, effectively, for so long on this crisis. And what we're trying to do is really shine a light on what's happening to children who are in detention in Libya, but also to the issue of migration from the very moment children leave their homes and make this extraordinary journey across the desert and then into Libya and indeed across the sea.
That's Sarah Crow, a spokesperson for UNICEF, speaking on a new report released today that reveals the horrific experience of migrant children trying to reach Europe. Details coming up.
Also, Somalia's president has declared a national disaster in his country as drought conditions worsen. And fleeing violence and food insecurity, thousands of South Sudanese refugees continue to cross the border into Uganda every day.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, more than 20 million people in South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and northeast Nigeria face extreme levels of food insecurity. That's the warning today from the International Organization for Migration. An IOM official says inaction could mean the starvation of millions. He says vital resources are needed to help those facing drought, food insecurity, and famine, adding that there is an opportunity to stop famine from spreading, but only if fast action is taken.
Somalia's president has declared a national disaster in his country as drought conditions worsen. More than 6 million people are reported in need of assistance. About half are in emergency or crisis situations. AFP reports Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed issued a statement today appealing to the international community to urgently respond to the calamity. The World Health Organization warned yesterday that Somalia was facing its third famine in 25 years. The last one, in 2011, killed some 260,000 people.
A new report from UNICEF says refugee and migrant children and women often experience sexual violence, exploitation, detention, and other abuses as they try to make their way from Libya to Italy. The report is called A Deadly Journey for Children, the Central Mediterranean Migrant Route. It provides an in-depth look at the extreme risk facing migrants and refugees. At least three-quarters of the children interviewed said they had experienced violence, harassment, or aggression at the hands of adults. And nearly half of the women and children interviewed reported repeated sexual abuse. Sarah Crow is a spokesperson for UNICEF. She spoke with me about the report and about their call for international action through a six-point plan for uprooted children.
What this shows is the level to which children have been in the shadows, effectively, for so long on this crisis. And what we're trying to do is really shine a light on what's happening to children who are in detention in Libya, but also to the issue of migration from the very moment children leave their homes and make this extraordinary journey. So what we're seeing is deeply disturbing. Children are lured by smugglers into making the crossing and indeed are left in this kind of limbo situation for months and months on end in detention in Libya.
When this survey was conducted, what type of psychological damage do you think was revealed when children are experiencing this?
Well, the damage may only be known in the long term. That's the sad fact of the matter. It's also in the statistics. We know that there are roughly 23,000 children who are refugee and migrant children who are in Libya currently, but the real figure is probably three times higher than that. And we just do not have the kind of access across the country because Libya is in a fragile situation right now. The crossing on the central Mediterranean is also the most deadly. Last year, 5,000 people lost their lives at sea, and it's an extraordinary number. And the real figures for children we may never know, because the majority of those arriving into Italy, 92% of them, are unaccompanied. They're traveling alone, and their deaths sadly go unreported and unrecorded. So not only is it what's happening at every step of the way across the Sahara, this extraordinary journey, but also in transit in Libya and indeed crossing the central Mediterranean. And once they arrive in Europe, it is just the beginning of another journey.
How do children get separated from their families? Does it start at the beginning, or are they sent alone, or the separation occurs just because of the types of people that they're with, the smugglers and traffickers?
There are many different reasons why children get separated, or indeed why they leave alone, why they leave their homes and travel alone in the first place. For example, story of a 9-year-old girl in the report in the Child Alert, whose name is Cammy, we call her. She was taken into the sea with her parents, and the boat, the rubber dinghy, collapsed, and she lost her parents at sea, and she was returned into a detention center. So there's almost this kind of recycling of migrants and refugees in these detention centers, almost as if people are a commodity. And then there are other reasons why, what we call the push factors that push people to leave their homes in the first place. And this can be a wide range of persecution, conflict. We know that many are leaving Boko Haram territory in northern Nigeria. Some girls from southern Nigeria are lured with a promise of a job, say as a hairdresser in Europe, and then they're forced into prostitution. So we're seeing a great range of stories and reasons why children are leaving their homes in the first place.
UNICEF has developed a 6-point plan of action for children that are uprooted. So how will this plan be implemented to really help?
And that's why we're calling really for solutions that are not just short-term responses, but actually with a long-term view, because migration is clearly here to stay. People will continue to move as long as there's a reason for them to leave their home in the first place. It's part of humanity. But we've seen this kind of level of suffering is really intolerable at the moment from what we're seeing in Libya and from what people, what children are going through at every step of the way. So what we're calling for is that children should be protected, particularly the unaccompanied, should be protected from exploitation and violence, that detention should never be a solution for migration, for children who are migrating, and that families should be kept together, because that's the best way to protect children and to give them legal status. So these are some of the things that we're calling on a number of member states, but particularly right now, of course, to the EU, because there are moves afoot to potentially return people to Libya. And this would not be the right move at the moment, because Libya is not a safe place for children who have already endured so much.
That was Sarah Crowe, a spokesperson for UNICEF. She spoke with me from Geneva.
Thousands of South Sudanese refugees continue to cross the border into Uganda every day. They're fleeing violence and food insecurity. At the same time, efforts are underway to meet their religious, health, and educational needs. Reporter Catherine Nambi has the story from Gulu District in northern Uganda.
It is not only the South Sudan nationals that are seeking shelter in Uganda following the civil war in their country. Kajokeji Health Training Institute, which was earlier located in Kajokeji town of South Sudan, is an education institution that has now relocated to Arua District in Uganda's West Nile region. Santa Gudowa, the institution's administrative assistant, says it is one of the many that were attacked by gunmen during the civil war. She adds that they have decided to open in Uganda since most of their students are currently in Uganda's refugee camps.
In September, when students were beginning their final examination, unknown gunmen attacked the school and 2 students were killed in the school. So that thing made students to become scared.
However, Isaac Drasili, The institute's deputy principal says the relocation has come at a huge cost, which has also affected the students' enrollment.
Here in Arua, we don't have a plot where the school is supposed to be. We are renting. The number of students who we expected to join has greatly declined because some are not able to afford the school fees because currently we are paying Ugandan shillings. The value of Ugandan shilling vis-a-vis pounds value, there is a great difference. So a quarter of the students are not able to join this academic year.
Located 50 kilometers from the Uganda border post at Nimule, Kajokeji town in Yeyu River State is one of the South Sudan towns nearest to Uganda and is 150 kilometers from the South Sudan capital Juba, which was the center of the fighting that broke out following renewed tension between President Salva Kiir and then Vice President Riek Machar. Also relocating to Uganda is the South Sudan Episcopal Church and Kajokeji Catholic Diocese, whose clergy, including the bishop and other diocesan, are in the process of relocating to Moyo District of Northern Uganda in an effort to cater for their flock that is currently sheltered in the refugee camps. William Anyama, a local district official in Moyo, has confirmed the development, adding that land has been secured to house the diocese and its entire clergy.
Already in the Moyo district, there was a space that was identified where probably the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan, the Diocese of Kajokeji and the Bishop and other people will be settled for now.
He says the relocation of religious institutions and their leaders is a sign that the situation in South Sudan is still fragile and more people are likely to flee into Uganda.
Religious leaders are also now moving away. In all circumstances of war, religious leaders are seen to be the last to leave. In most cases, they don't. And people under worst circumstances even take refuge in the mission, in the church areas. Now you imagine a situation where even the bishop is moving away. Who else can remain?
Onono Onwen, a retired Anglican bishop of Gulu Diocese in northern Uganda, says there is need for religious leaders from Uganda and neighboring countries to join those of South Sudan in preaching return of peace.
What is happening in South Sudan is affecting the neighboring countries. Therefore, the neighboring inter-religious council should play a big role in what is happening in South Sudan to see that peace is restored. Because if they don't, the refugees are overwhelming in number. If they don't do something, the impact will also be very serious on them.
According to United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, more South Sudan refugees continue to flee from their homes, with almost 2,400 arriving in Uganda every day on average. Reporting for VOA, this is Catherine Nambi in Gulu District of Northern Uganda.
18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Nigeria's economy shrank by 1.5% last year as the country fell into recession. High inflation, low oil prices, and a tax on oil production facilities in the Niger Delta were to blame. However, AFP reports there is a glimmer of hope for the Nigerian economy. The government is negotiating with rebels who have stopped their attacks. Analysts say if oil production holds steady for increases, the Nigerian economy could grow this year. But they add the non-oil sector still faces double-digit inflation, foreign exchange shortages, and power outages.
About 2 million people a year contract leishmaniasis, which can cause disfiguring skin ulcers. It's considered a neglected tropical disease, so it is difficult to find investment for new therapies. But University of Pennsylvania researchers say the key to new treatment may be found in the body's immune system. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
The World Health Organization says leishmaniasis affects some of the world's poorest people. It's caused by parasites transmitted by more than 90 species of sandflies. The WHO says the disease is linked to urbanization, deforestation, and the construction of dams and irrigation systems. Skin ulcers can last for months or years and can cause major tissue damage in some cases. internal organs, mainly the spleen, liver, and bone marrow, can also be affected by one of three types of the disease. The study's senior author is Philip Scott, professor of immunology at the University of Pennsylvania. He began researching the Leishmania parasite in Brazil 30 years ago. Scott found the parasite fascinating because it lived in human immune cells called macrophages, which should have killed it.
These are the cells that you would think would be eating things like bacteria and fungi and protozoa to kill them. But this particular parasite, like other pathogens such as leprosy or TB, lives inside macrophages and is not killed.
Scott and his colleagues began to focus on the immune system's T cells, which release molecules that activate the macrophages. But some T cells actually made things worse.
In patients, we saw a lot of T cells that were associated with increased damage and increased pathology. And so it was really looking at the patients and what was happening in the patient that led us to focus on this particular type of T cell.
Scott says these T cells attack infected cells, but the results can be less than perfect.
These T cells are cytolytic T cells, so they kill infected targets, they kill infected macrophages, these cells that the parasites are living in. But unfortunately, instead of killing the parasite just escapes and infects other macrophages. And so what happens is you have a lot of cell death that's occurring in the skin, and that leads to inflammation. And what we've been tracking down over the last year or 2 years is really what the mechanisms by which that inflammation occurs.
While inflammation is the body's natural response to infection, for a person with leishmaniasis, it can make symptoms, such as skin ulcers, worse. So researchers say the skin damage may have less to do with the parasite and more to do with an immune system out of control. Researchers have identified the pathway that leads to inflammation. Scott says they may have found a way to block it, and the means to do it may already exist or be in development.
We know that actually it's a pathway that occurs in other situations where there are drugs that are being developed. So, for example, would be rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, those inflammatory type of diseases. And the wonderful thing right now is there's a variety of drugs being designed for what are, you might consider, first world diseases that may be applicable to this particular neglected disease.
Scott explains what he calls the researcher's hope and hypothesis.
The idea is that we would treat with these drugs that block that inflammatory response, and hence the patients would resolve their disease much quicker.
Several expensive anti-inflammatory drugs are being considered for use in a small clinical trial. One advantage is that these drugs have already been tested for safety. But it may still take about a year to get the trial up and running. The goal is to find cheaper drugs that do the same thing. There are a few unanswered questions. Some people do not show any symptoms when infected with the Leishmania parasite. Scott says they don't know why yet. Could this hypothesis be applied to all three types of the disease? That's not clear. The first clinical trial would focus on the one causing skin ulcers. And what happens to those parasites that escape when the T cells destroy the macrophages? They have an answer for that one. Professor Scott says, as part of their trial, researchers would combine an anti-inflammatory drug with a known antiparasitic medication. So maybe the disease could be treated with far fewer skin ulcers. Scott says there's even a chance that once inflammation is under control, the antiparasitic drug would not be needed. The immune system would no longer be out of control and better able to kill the parasites. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Islamic State extremists have repeatedly targeted Christian residents in northern Sinai, causing more than 100 families to flee from the city of El Arish. IS militants recently vowed to step up a wave of attacks on the embattled Christian minority, targeting vulnerable civilians instead of the usual police and military targets. Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is the former director of State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy asked him about the incitement of bigotry against Coptic Christians and whether that means the propaganda of the Islamic State is entering a new phase.
Yes and no. The propaganda of the Islamic State about Christians in general, religious minorities in general, is nothing new, and it goes back to the beginning of the Islamic State in 2006. But you certainly have seen a much stronger emphasis, certainly in Egypt, on attacking Coptic Christians, attacking churches in the last few months. So this is not a new theme, but it seems to have become more intense in the recent past.
Do you think it is a replica of the jihadi anti-Copt propaganda that was used in the 70s during a period when these groups began to target Christians for robbery and death?
Yes, it is. The roots in Egypt, certainly, of this type of organized sectarian violence go back to the 1970s when the Muslim Brotherhood was allowed space in Sadat's Egypt, and then you had these Takfiri terrorist groups splinter off from it. And they targeted two things. They targeted Christians for robbery and killing, and they targeted government officials, often local policemen. So you do have to put the latest threats within the context of, yes, the Islamic State is threatening Christians and wants to kill them and wants to incite violence against them. But the other threat, of course, is against the Egyptian state, the Egyptian leadership, and all Egyptians, Muslim or Christian.
But the video showed Christians asking for protection from President Sisi and claimed that he cannot protect his own soldiers in Sinai.
Well, this is a propaganda video. So obviously what they do is they try to take clips and twist it and manipulate it to give it as sharp an edge as possible. So that's why they're doing. They're, in a way, they're not mocking, when they make this claim, they're not mocking the Christians, they're mocking the government. What they're saying is they ask for protection, but he can't even protect his own soldiers in Sinai. So it's a way of attacking the government, taunting the government.
What was the most remarkable thing about this video, as it is threatening the largest Christian minority in the Middle East?
To me, the most remarkable thing and the most troubling thing is that the Islamic State is betting that there is enough of a pool of bigoted, prejudiced Muslims, you know, non-Coptic Christians, who are going to like this kind of message. So to me, it seems a very bold strategy, betting on extremism, betting on hatred. And I hope and pray that the good Egyptian people, you know, will live up to their historic traditions of unity, of concord, and of patriotism, and actually that this attempt by the Islamic State to promote sectarian tensions and violence will fail completely.
What are the challenges for those who want to counter such a propaganda approach?
Well, they need to look at what the Islamic State is saying and treat it seriously. If ISIS propaganda says that people should be killed because they fall into a certain category, and they give these categories labels like kafir or mushrik or murtad, you know, infidel, polytheist, or apostate, we need to address these issues of the other, of who do you call an infidel, who do you call polytheist, who do you call an apostate, and what that means needs to be addressed. These are weapons that cannot be left in the hands of the extremists. They must be taken from them.
That was Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, the former director of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the latest political developments in Somalia as the country moves forward under the leadership of newly elected President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.